Joseph or Jung by William J. Hamblin, read by Daniel C. Peterson. Nibley treats Mormon scripture primarily through parallels. While we need not pay any attention to those shallow critics of Nibley who merely shout parallelomania as if it were a magical incantation and reject his whole methodology and corpus out of hand, drawing parallels is a necessary technique for any scholar. One must simply judge each parallel separately to see what validity it offers. And many of Nibley's parallels are convincing and valuable, while others are less persuasive or informative. This technique requires careful analysis of the passages to be compared. Todd Compton. In a dialogue article published in 2000, Douglas F. Salmon offered a foray into the debate surrounding the historicity of unique Latter-day Saint scriptures. His paper attempts to make two basic points. First, the search for parallels between Latter-day Saint scripture and antiquity is methodologically flawed. Second, whatever seemingly authentic parallels have been found are better explained by a Jungian collective unconscious than by an authentic historical connection between Latter-day Saint scripture and antiquity. I find his arguments unconvincing. Although Salmon does not make an explicit claim, and I may therefore be mistaken on this matter, I sense a corollary assumption that while Latter-day Saint scriptures could perhaps be called inspired in the Jungian sense, that they reflect Joseph Smith's inspired connection with the collective unconscious, they are not revealed in the traditional sense that they represent authentic records of the Nephites, Enoch, or others. A fundamental problem with Salmon's paper is that he attempts to demonstrate the failure of an entire methodology, the study of parallels between purportedly ancient Latter-day Saint scripture and other ancient writings, by attempting to demonstrate that Hugh Nibley, in a single work written a quarter of a century ago, has allegedly made half a dozen errors. As I will demonstrate below, Salmon is mistaken about several of the errors he claims to have found. But even if he were correct that Nibley is mistaken in all half a dozen cases, at best, this would demonstrate that Nibley is human and makes errors. Of course, all scholars make errors. This does not demonstrate that Nibley's entire thesis on Enoch is wrong, since Salmon does not acknowledge, let alone begin to deal with, either Nibley's overall argument or his strongest evidence. Suppose Nibley claimed to have discovered 50 parallels between Enoch materials in the Book of Moses and ancient Enoch traditions, and suppose that Salmon conclusively demonstrated that half of these are not authentic parallels. Still, 25 parallels would remain unchallenged. More important, Salmon does not deal with Nibley's overall argument. Arguments are composed of multiple pieces of evidence and analysis. The demonstration that a few pieces of evidence are in error does not necessarily mean that the argument as a whole is wrong, especially when multiple pieces of evidence supporting the argument remain. Salmon has the responsibility to demonstrate that the parallels he believes he has undermined are essential to Nibley's overall argument, and therefore that the argument is faulty. A critique must deal not only with errors of fact, but also with broader analysis and arguments. Furthermore, discovering errors in one of Nibley's books does not demonstrate that all of Nibley's other books are equally unsound, and it particularly fails to demonstrate that all works by all other scholars supporting the historicity of unique Latter-day Saint scriptures are likewise methodologically flawed. Moreover, it certainly does not demonstrate that the method of adducing parallels is inherently defective. The fact that someone uses a methodology incorrectly does not demonstrate that the methodology itself is flawed, only that it was improperly used. If a doctor botches a heart surgery and a patient suffers, it does not mean that the doctor has therefore killed all his other patients, and it certainly should not lead us to abandon heart surgery altogether. Another serious error in the application of Salmon's theory is that he fails to see he is wielding a double-edged sword. If the search for ancient parallels with Latter-day Saint scripture is methodologically flawed, is the search for 19th century parallels not also flawed? There are actually two separate questions here. One, is the search for cultural and literary parallels a useful, but not the only, method in attempting to discover the original context of a document of uncertain provenance? And two, does Nibley attempt to apply this method, and does he do so properly? Salmon never clearly engages these questions. On the one hand, he uses parallels to attempt to demonstrate that Joseph could have obtained the idea of multiple worlds from his early 19th century environment, and finding parallels to the Book of Abraham through a 19th century reading of the Bible seems to indicate he accepts the usefulness of this method, at least in principle. On the other hand, he insists that, quote, the use of parallels from apocryphal literature to prove the prophetic status of Joseph Smith is a misguided endeavor that is simply ill-suited for the task, end quote. Why searching for 19th century parallels should be particularly interesting, but searching for ancient parallels misguided, is never explained. In fact, the method of adducing parallels in an attempt to determine historical context, although it can certainly be abused, is a widely accepted methodology used by scholars in a number of fields. For example, Mircea Eliade, whom Salmon cites with favor in his paper, uses parallelism extensively in his highly regarded works on comparative religions. And parallelism is the foundation of Jungian archetypes, which Salmon advocates. Rather than paying careful attention to the implications of the truly staggering, quote-unquote, parallels that have been discovered by Latter-day Saint scholars, Salmon is more concerned with continually raising the bar. Whenever a parallel is found to one characteristic in Latter-day Saint scripture, no matter how impressive, some critics always reply, yes, but there is no parallel to this other characteristic, as if this somehow undermined the parallels that do exist. Salmon's treatment of parallels between the Book of Abraham and ancient Abraham traditions is a case in point. After summarily dismissing a number of weak parallels, quote-unquote, to ancient traditions about Abraham, without mentioning more than a dozen others that I find much stronger, he writes, "What is missing here, and would indeed be quite remarkable if found, is an ancient source that mentions the star named Kolob, which is nearest to the throne of God." In fact, there is a possible reference in Jewish literature to a governing star named KLB. In the Ethiopic Book of Enoch, 1st Enoch, we find mention of stars which are leaders or governors of the year. One of these is called in Ethiopic Zelebsael. Now, the Ethiopic Book of Enoch derives ultimately from an Aramaic original, and many of the star names in this book bear recognizable Aramaic names. For example, Berkael, the lightning of God, and Narel, the light of God. However, the name Zelebsael makes no sense in Aramaic, and according to Michael A. Knibb, the editor of the Ethiopic manuscript, the form of this name, Zelebsael, would appear to be corrupt. Otto Neugebauer agrees that there was probably an early mutilation of the manuscript. Indeed, there are several variant readings of this name in the various Ethiopic manuscripts. Is there another possible reading of the Ethiopic Zelebsael that would make sense in Aramaic? In Ethiopic, the letter Za bears a very close resemblance to the letter Ka. Za has a small additional mark on the upper right part of the letter. Thus, the two letters could be easily confused. Assuming, then, an Ethiopic scribal error of Za for Ka, for the admittedly corrupt reading of Zelebsael, we arrive at Kelebsael, which in Aramaic could translate as the Kaleb of God, Sha'el meaning simply of God in Aramaic. Since early Aramaic and Hebrew lacked vowels, it's quite possible to read KLB in that word as Kolob. Salmon's accusation that Nibley and his followers, quote-unquote, lack a, quote, clearly articulated methodology, end quote, for the study of parallels is defensible only because Salmon is either unaware of such articulations or has chosen not to mention them. I have written on aspects of the matter a number of times. Indeed, Salmon must be at least partially aware of this fact, since he cites me, whom I suspect many would view as a follower of Nibley, as advocating precisely the proper methodology which Salmon claims Nibley's, quote, followers, end quote, don't follow and have never articulated. Specifically, with regard to the question of the proper use of parallels, I argued a decade ago. If one issues to discuss divergent models for the origin of the Book of Mormon, the proper methodology is to be followed is, one, assume that the book is an authentic ancient record and analyze it from this perspective. Two, assume that the book is a 19th century document and analyze it from this perspective. Three, compare and contrast the successes, failures, and relative explanatory power of the results of these studies. Four, attempt to discover which model is the most plausible explanation for the origin of the text. For the most part, Nibley is generally engaged only in phase one of this four-part process. Furthermore, I have twice noted elsewhere that I believe the proper method of dealing with parallelisms is to follow the procedures advocated by Jonathan Z. Smith, one of the leading contemporary historians of religion. Homology, causal antecedent, is a similarity of form or structure between two species shared from their common ancestor. An analogy is a similarity of form or structure between two species not sharing a common ancestor. It is agreed that the statement X resembles Y is logically incomplete because it suppresses the multi-term statement of analogy and difference capable of being properly expressed in formulations such as X resembles Y more than Z with respect to, or X resembles Y more than W resembles Z with respect to. That is to say, the statement of comparison is never dyadic, but always triadic. There is always an implicit more than, and there is always a with respect to. Now, Salmon may find Smith's approach to the methodology of analyzing parallelisms faulty. If so, he should argue accordingly. But in all fairness, he can hardly claim that no one associated with the Foundation for Ancient Research in Mormon Studies, FARMS, has ever dealt with the methodological issues before. Several of us have. Nibley also has clearly articulated his methodology and its limits. Our purpose is to illustrate, explain, suggest, and investigate. We're going to consider the Book of Mormon as a possible product not of ancient America, for that is totally beyond our competence, but of the ancient Near East, which is only slightly less so. Proving the Book of Mormon is another matter. A major problem with many critics of Nibley, such as Salmon, is that they assert that Nibley is alleging a probative value for his parallels, which he himself never claims. They critique Nibley for his failure to accomplish Phase 4, in my categorization, when he is clearly engaging only in Phase 1. Many other scholars associated with FARMS have written on methodological issues as well. Why does Salmon not engage these discussions? Why simply assert that such discussions don't exist? Salmon provides no evidence that Nibley's followers, whom he never precisely identifies but clearly links to FARMS, have committed the same errors that Salmon claims to have found in Nibley. Assertion in this regard is not even evidence, let alone proof. If Salmon wishes his claims to be taken seriously, he must engage each author and argument individually. In scholarship, there is no communal responsibility for error. We believe that scholars will be punished for their own books and not for Nibley's transgressions. Salmon claims that his specific criticisms of Nibley demonstrate not only the methodological malpractice of Nibley, but that of all his followers. Some of these criticisms will be briefly discussed here, but first it is important to note Nibley's own views on errors in his scholarly work, as reported by David Seeley. Nibley has never claimed for himself the kind of infallibility that some have attributed to him. He has always maintained that scholarship is a high-spirited and open conversation. For example, in regard to his own work on the Abraham facsimiles, he once said, "I refuse to be held responsible for anything I wrote more than 3 years ago. For heaven's sake, I hope we're moving forward here. After all, the implication is that one mistake and it's all over with. How flattering to think in 40 years I've not made one slip and I'm still in business. I would say about 4/5 of everything I've put down has changed, of course." I've always assumed Nibley would be delighted for us to read his work critically, and statements such as the above should be taken as invitations to join the fray. Salmon first insists that Nibley claims that the 7th century conflict of Adam and Eve with Satan contains, quote, perhaps the oldest Adam traditions, end quote. Salmon criticizes Nibley because the conflict is a 7th century text with Christian interpolations and therefore cannot be the oldest Adam tradition. Here's what Nibley actually says. "Perhaps the oldest Adam traditions are those collected from all over the ancient Near East at a very early time, which have reached us in later Ethiopian and Arabic manuscripts under the title of The Combat of Adam and Eve Against Satan. It contains at least 13 different showdowns between Adam and the adversary. The motif was characteristically repeated with variations. The monkish mind could not resist the temptation to work a good thing to death." From Nibley's entire statement in context, it is quite clear that Nibley recognizes that the Ethiopian and Arabic combat is not itself the oldest tradition, but is in part a collection of earlier Adam material, a fact on which all scholars agree. Nibley even alludes to the Christian interpolations in the text by mentioning the monkish editors. Salmon has distorted Nibley's position, claiming Nibley is in error. He also criticizes Nibley for a, quote, lack of precision, end quote. His single example, in a published work from 1975, Nibley discusses R.H. Charles's list of 128 examples of the possible influence of 1st Enoch on the New Testament, whereas a decade later, in a transcript from a classroom lecture, Nibley misstates that there are 128 examples of quotations from 1st Enoch in the New Testament. I'm sorry, but such a simple misstatement in a lecture in which Nibley had only a few seconds to formulate a sentence, hardly amounts to a demonstration of serious methodological error in Nibley's work. After giving thousands of lectures to students, often with limited or no notes, we should not be surprised to find that Nibley made misstatements on occasion. Salmon claims Nibley misrepresents the significance of the parallel between the baptism of Adam in Moses 6:52 and the baptism of Adam in the Apocalypse of Adam, an ancient text. For Salmon, the baptism in the Apocalypse of Adam is purely metaphorical or spiritualized. Nibley, therefore, misrepresents a metaphorical baptism of Adam as a literal water baptism, though how this undermines Adam's association with baptism is unclear. To emphasize his point, Salmon correctly cites Kurt Rudolph as saying, "The act of knowledge, gnosis, is understood as baptism at the close of the Apocalypse of Adam," end quote. Unfortunately, like the legendary sorcerer's apprentice, Salmon should have read a little further in the book, since Rudolph gives numerous examples of physical baptism among the Gnostics as well. The two were not mutually exclusive. A physical baptism symbolically represented the spiritual reception of saving knowledge, gnosis. Thus, the mere fact that baptism includes a spiritual transformation through gnosis does not necessarily imply that an actual ritual was not practiced as well. Other Christians understood the dual nature of baptism. The Church Father Justin wrote, "This washing, baptism, is called illumination, because they who learn these things are illuminated in their understandings." Does this mean that no physical ritual took place among early Christians, or merely that they saw a spiritual reality symbolized by the physical ritual? Several of Salmon's other criticisms of Nibley also disappear under careful scrutiny. When Nibley finds an interesting parallel between Enoch's observation of God weeping in Moses 7:28-29 and Jewish traditions about a similar event, Salmon protests that God is also described as weeping in the Old Testament, citing Jeremiah 13:15-17, which he claims could therefore have been the source for this incident in the book of Moses. Salmon quotes the following verses from Jeremiah 13:15-17. "Pay heed, be not too proud to listen, for it is the Lord who speaks. If in those depths you will not listen, then for very anguish I can only weep bitterly. My eyes must stream with tears, for the Lord's flock is carried off into captivity." Salmon, by leaving out verse 16, attempts to have it appear that the Lord is weeping here. In reality, it is Jeremiah, not the Lord, who weeps for Judah. This is what the reader of the entire passage in the King James Version would have understood. "Hear ye and give ear, be not proud, for the Lord hath spoken. Give glory to the Lord your God before he cause darkness, and before your feet stumble upon the dark mountains. And while ye look for light, he turn it into the shadow of death, and make it gross darkness. But if ye will not hear it, my soul shall weep in secret places for your pride, and mine eyes shall weep sore and run down with tears, because the Lord's flock is carried away captive." Throughout this passage, it is clear that the Lord is spoken of by Jeremiah in the third person. Jeremiah is speaking in the first person, and it is therefore Jeremiah who weeps. Indeed, Jeremiah is sometimes called the weeping prophet because of the repeated weeping and lamentations mentioned in his writings. Thus, Nibley's point stands. Both the book of Moses and Jewish traditions describe Enoch observing God weeping. The Bible does not. Salmon's critique of Nibley engages in precisely the type of selectivity and misreading of which he accuses Nibley. Salmon is also in error in his discussion of the plurality of worlds. He rightly quotes Nibley as claiming the idea of multiple worlds found in Moses 1:33-37 was offensive to the doctors or fathers of the church. He then quotes Origen, who was indeed a doctor of the church, as stating, "God did not begin to work on creation for the first time when he made this visible world, but just as after the dissolution of this world there will be another one, so also we believe that there were others before this one existed." But contra Salmon, Origen is not saying there are multiple simultaneously existing worlds, as described in Moses 1:35. "There are many worlds that now stand, and innumerable are they unto man." Rather, Origen is talking about a succession of worlds, one after the other, with only one existing at any given time. We must not suppose, however, that several worlds existed at the same time, but that after this one, another will exist in its turn. Thus, Salmon has misread Origen, blaming his confusion on Nibley, who is in fact correct. Salmon attempts to further undermine Nibley's position that the Christian fathers rejected a multiplicity of simultaneous worlds by quoting the pagan philosophers Democritus, Epicurus, and Lucretius, none of whom were church fathers. In reality, by citing these three examples, Salmon has provided additional evidence that the idea of multiple worlds found in the Book of Moses was an ancient one, which is Nibley's real point. Nibley's arguing that the idea of the multiplicity of worlds, though rejected by the Christian fathers, was accepted by many others in antiquity. Therefore, the Book of Moses' discussion of multiple worlds makes sense in an ancient milieu. Salmon criticizes Nibley for allegedly taking his sources out of context and misrepresenting his sources, which is precisely what Salmon has done in this case. If Salmon is correct in his assumption that methodological mistakes by Nibley do not simply invalidate a single argument, but undermine all of Nibley's other works, and through guilt by association, all the writing of Nibley's followers at Farms, could we reasonably conclude that Salmon's entire article is invalidated by his misreading of Origen and Jeremiah, and furthermore that the work of all authors who have ever published in dialogue should also be summarily dismissed? Perhaps a careful analysis of each argument by each author is a superior method to the sweeping dismissal advocated by Salmon, based on a mere half-dozen alleged errors, many of which turn out to be claims based on mistakes and misinterpretations by Salmon himself. Salmon also provides four early 19th century sources that talk about the idea of plurality of worlds, concluding that in the case of the notion of a plurality of worlds, Enochic literature is by no means unique in providing parallels. Quite true, but neither are the early 19th century parallels that Salmon adduces. Why should the 19th century parallels provided by Salmon be seen as methodologically privileged and hence acceptable, while the ancient parallels provided by Nibley are considered methodologically faulty and therefore unacceptable? Both use precisely the same methodology, attempting to contextualize a document whose date and origin is disputed by examining parallels to the proposed original culture. In fact, on this particular point, both the ancient and 19th century models can explain Moses 1:33-37. On the other hand, despite the errors he claims to have found in Nibley's writings, Salmon admits that this is not to say that there are no legitimate parallels between documents from the ancient Near East and latter-day scripture. In fact, he finds these parallels a truly staggering, undeniable fact. And indeed, the vast majority of Nibley's parallels in his Enoch studies, let alone his entire literary corpus, are not examined by Salmon, nor even mentioned. Thus, he is admitting that despite occasional errors and disputed cases, authentic parallels between Latter-day Saint scriptures and ancient writings have indeed been found by Nibley and others. But since he apparently does not wish to consider the possibility that the existence of a parallel in an ancient text can confirm the prophetic insight of Joseph Smith, Salmon attempts to offer an alternative theory to explain the unchallenged parallels, thereby, I suspect, tacitly hoping to undermine the historicity of Smith's scriptures. In fact, Salmon's issue with Nibley is not really parallelomania. The odd irony here is that the Jungian psychology that Salmon advocates necessitates the acceptance of far more parallels between religions of many different times and places than does Nibley's approach to ancient scripture. In the second half of his paper, Salmon offers what he considers a superior alternative to the historical comparative analysis of textual and cultural parallels by turning to Carl Jung's theory of archetypes and the collective unconsciousness, for which he attempts to enlist the support of the magisterial historian of religions, Mircea Eliade. To begin with, Salmon simply misunderstands Eliade. Salmon seems to think that because Eliade and Jung both used the term archetype, they were therefore kindred spirits, quote-unquote. This seriously misrepresents the ideas of both Jung and Eliade. While Salmon acknowledges that the term archetype, quote, meant subtly different things to each man, end quote, he fails to define this distinction, which is fundamental, not subtle. For Eliade, archetype is a historical concept used, quote, to name the sacred paradigms that are expressed in myth and articulated in ritual, end quote. For Jung, archetype refers to, quote, the dynamic structures of the unconscious that determine individual patterns of experience and behavior, end quote. Although they use the same term, in reality, Jung knew and accepted the concepts of Iliada archetype as transcendent model. But in addition, for Jung, the archetype was also active in determining the inner psychological life of man. For comparison purposes, Iliada's archetype should be called historical archetypes, while Jung should be called psychological archetypes. Thus, the agreement between the two was only at Iliada's historical level. Iliada did not accept Jung's idea of a collective unconscious, nor did he believe that myths and archetypes were created by this collective unconscious. And this disagreement centered on Jung's main point. This is obvious even in quotation given by Salmon when attempting to demonstrate the affinity of Iliada and Jung. Iliada states explicitly, quote, "We do not mean to say that mythologies are the product of the unconscious," precisely contradicting Jung on this point. It is unclear why Salmon thinks this passage demonstrates that Iliada and Jung are in essential agreement about psychological archetypes and the collective unconscious. Salmon's major argument is that Jungian psychology offers a superior model for explaining the parallels between Latter-day Saint scripture and antiquity that Nibley and many others have found. The potential compatibility of Jungian psychology, which essentially reductionistically downgrades religious experiences to merely psychological experiences, with Latter-day Saint ideas, is a question that could merit a detailed and nuanced study. Unfortunately, Salmon does not provide this. Instead, he asserts that the Latter-day Saint concept of the light of Christ, quote, "in many regards is an analog to the Jungian notion of the collective unconscious," end quote. But this is nonsense. The Latter-day Saint idea that all people have the light of Christ, sometimes described as a combination of reason, intelligence, intuition, and inspiration, is not at all parallel to the Jungian collective unconscious. A collective conscience must not be confused with a collective unconscious. The light of Christ is an external force that proceeds from God. It is not an internal psychological instinct. It is a divine power exterior to man. Likewise, the idea that all religions have important truths and that many religious leaders, including non-Christians such as Muhammad, Zoroaster, the Buddha, and Confucius, were inspired by God is not a closet form of the Jungian collective unconscious. Inspiration from God has never been understood in the Latter-day Saint tradition as some form of collective unconscious or even as an individual psychological intuition or instinct. If we're to move down the path Salmon proposes, we should first clearly understand exactly what it is that Salmon is suggesting, a radical transformation of our understanding of inspiration, revelation, and scripture. Moses, Jesus, Paul, and Joseph Smith would thereby become nothing more than additional instances of people who articulated ideas inherent in all of humanity's most basic psychological structures, but they would not be termed world prophets, nor would Jesus be the Christ. Salmon's attempt to replace careful historical analysis of parallels and comparison of the possible 19th century or ancient context of Latter-day Saint scripture with vague Jungian archetypes fails at another level. Whereas Salmon's Jungian psychology might be able to explain why many different groups throughout history have worshipped the sun as a god, it is quite unhelpful in explaining why so many different groups represent the sun god as riding in a chariot. Whereas Jungian theory might help us to understand why so many different religious traditions have myths of great spiritual heroes who reveal divine truths, it is monumentally unhelpful in explaining why one of these was called Enoch, who is said to have done and said very specific things that sometimes find parallels in the Book of Moses, such as ascending to heaven. And it is certainly useless in explaining the appearance of the name Mahuja or Mahija in both the Book of Moses and the Enochian materials in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Are we to believe that all people have the name Mahuja in their collective unconscious? In other words, the Jungian theory of the collective unconscious can at best explain parallels in the most general and vague patterns in religion, if that. But it cannot explain parallels in the details of specific historical manifestations of those generic patterns. Whether Nibley is right or wrong about specific ancient parallels he claims to have found to the Book of Moses, Jungian theory cannot explain them. Thus, if Salmon is calling for using ever more sophisticated methods in studying and comparing the proposed 19th century and ancient parallels to Latter-day Saint scripture, I vigorously support this call and encourage him to begin such an effort by applying them to his own work. If there are faulty arguments, and Salmon has perhaps found a few, we should weed them out on both sides of the debate. But if, as it seems, He is calling for the abandonment of the scholarly, critical, historical enterprise to be replaced by attribution of parallels between Latter-day Saint scripture and ancient texts to a Jungian collective unconscious. I'll stick with Joseph over Jung.